Welcome, Hadavar students, to our next session in the First Regathering, Zionism and the History of the Modern State of Israel. We're in session 12, dealing with the rise of Zionism. Now let's have a quick review of where we were last session. Last session we took a look at the McDonald White Paper, which caused massive demonstrations throughout the land of Palestine and around the Jewish world. The United Jewish Appeal was founded. The Lehi underground movement got started. The Palmach, the strike forces, were begun, the Palmach. In 1942, there were massacres in occupied Russia. The death camps of Auschwitz, Majdanek, Treblinka began to function at full capacity. So this was a dark time in the Jewish world. The Struma sinks in the Black Sea with 769 refugees, creating an uproar worldwide. In 1944, Etzel and Lehi began to strike at the British. One of the strikes by the Stern Gang was the murder of the Egyptian minister resident Lord Moyne in Cairo. The Jewish Brigade is organized and fights in Italy. 1945, World War II finally comes to an end. And as we take a look at all that was happening, we saw that the attempts by the various commissions to make the Jewish homeland smaller and smaller and smaller is an attack on the land promise. Satan is influencing the nations to attempt to squeeze the physical existence of the Jewish national home out of existence and therefore eliminate the land promise. And then in World War II, the Holocaust was an attack on the seed promise or the nation promise, an attack on the people that would inherit that land and occupy that land. So Satan is busy trying to undermine the Abrahamic covenant because he knows if he can do that, then his career is safe. Then we reviewed the importance of World Wars I and II. World War I marked the beginning of the end of the age eschatologically. So we've been in the end of the age since 1914. And then World War I provided the opportunity for the Jewish national home. The Ottoman Empire had been tossed out of the Middle East. The British had taken over one of the mandates in the Middle East, and they were positive toward a Jewish national home at that time and wanted to set one up. Then World War II dramatized the need for the Jewish national home in that one-third of the worldwide Jewish community had been suffered anti-Semitic execution during the Holocaust. But then came Bevin's declaration on Israel, where he said 100,000 displaced persons in Europe, displaced Jewish persons in Europe, should not be allowed into Israel. President Harry S. Truman felt differently, and he sent Mr. Harrison there to check out the situation of the DPs. The Harrison report came back saying 100,000 Jewish DPs should be allowed into Israel immediately. And the British reacted against that, saying nothing doing, and so illegal immigration intensified. This was called Aliyah Plan B. The director had always been Shaul Avigdor, but this time the scope of Aliyah Beit was greatly increased. Cooperation between the Haganah and Etzel began, and so there was sabotage throughout British Palestine, sabotaging rail links, military installations, and etc. So that brings us to the new material. We come to 1946 and the Anglo-American Committee and its conclusions. In 1946, Britain formulated a new compromise approach to Truman's request to let the 100,000 DPs into Israel. So note this is a British initiative. On October 26, 1945, before the House of Commons, and on November 13th, in a letter to the American president, Prime Minister Attlee proposed a joint Anglo-American committee to investigate the tragedy of the refugees and devise a solution to it. So the British love committees, don't they? Truman accepted the challenge with the qualification that Palestine alone, rather than any alternative refuge, would become the focus of the inquiry. Bevin and Attlee grudgingly accepted this condition. And here's a photograph of David Ben-Gurion. He's on the left there testifying before the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry. A unanimous report of less than 100 pages was issued on May 1, 1946. It recommended the immediate authorization of 100,000 immigration certificates. The report turned down either an Arab or a Jewish state. It didn't offer a detailed solution, but it proposed a regime in which further Jewish immigration would neither be subject to an Arab veto nor be allowed to grow to such numbers as to produce a Jewish majority. And during the interim, the mandate would continue to function. Well, the Anglo-American report was categorically rejected. London's response was frigid. Isn't that interesting hypocrisy? London suggested the whole idea and then totally rejected its recommendations. The text of the document was published in Washington on May 1st, 1946, and on the same day, Truman publicly announced his approval of the recommendations for admitting 100,000 displaced persons into Palestine. And this report is available if you'd like to read it. It's called A Survey of Palestine and apparently is available on Amazon.com. Now, E.F. Francis Williams, Bevin's friend and biographer, wrote later that Truman's statement threw Bevin into one of the blackest rages he had ever seen him in. Now, if rejection of Truman's appeal was a serious tactical blunder, Bevin insisted on compounding it by the harsh insensitivity of his remarks. Thus, his irritated reaction to the president's position was to declare publicly now, that the Americans favored the admission of 100,000 Jews into Palestine because, quote, they didn't want too many of them in New York, end quote. And that's an anti-Semitic, bigoted statement. The outrage provoked by this statement was not limited to the Jews. Sailing to the United States shortly afterward, Bevin discovered that the stevedores in the port of New York refused to handle his baggage. So there's just a little bit of payback there on the docks of New York. Now, Edsel blows up the King David Hotel. On July 22, 1946, a group of armed Edsel members entered the kitchen of the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. An entire wing of the building was occupied by government offices, together with the headquarters of the CID, the Criminal Investigation Division. The saboteurs deposited heavy milk cans packed with Gelgonite, that's a form of dynamite, in the hotel's lower quarters. Time fuses were lit, and the men departed. Now, according to Begin's later account, a warning of the impending explosion was telephoned to the CID, but the British subsequently denied that the warnings ever were received. When the explosion went off in the hotel 25 minutes later, 91 Britishers, Arabs, and Jews were killed, 45 were injured. Now here's the King David Hotel in 1931. This is the King David Hotel at the moment of the explosion. Of course, the saboteurs knew exactly when the bombs would go off, so they had the camera ready, didn't they? And this is the King David Hotel aftermath of the explosion. You can see the entire wing of the hotel is gone. Here's another view from the ground. That entire wing of the King David Hotel has disappeared into rubble. And of course, this is the King David Hotel today. Everything has been rebuilt, and it is a beautiful, beautiful hotel. If you go to Jerusalem, visit the King David Hotel. Well, let me back up there for Menachem Begin. Okay. The British agency was no less horrified than the British government by the King David bombing. Ben-Gurion, who had never brought himself totally to disavow either underground raids on British installations, now furiously condemned the Etzel and urged Palestine Jewry to turn its members in whenever they were discovered. On a later occasion, the Haganah managed to foil an Etzel scheme to blow up the British police headquarters in Tel Aviv. So here's Menachem Begin. Menachem Begin and his men were not easily deterred. Rather, they intensified their attacks on military transport, destroying vehicles, paralyzing railroad traffic, and occasionally killing British personnel. The British began to deport illegal immigrants to Cyprus. Early in 1946, the British intensified their blockade against illegal immigration. With nearly 8,000 displaced persons sailing from Italian ports by then, Interception was almost certain, usually just inside Palestine territorial waters. The refugees were forcibly transferred to British vessels and carried off to Cyprus. Now, Cyprus, here's, I'll show you Cyprus. Here is a map of the Middle East, and Cyprus is this large island in the Mediterranean. So let's zoom in on Cyprus, and we're going to turn our attention to that particular peninsula, that southern peninsula on Cyprus, and that's the location of the Cyprus DP camps, one camp to the north and one camp to the south of that peninsula. To discourage immigration, the internment camps on Cyprus were made as forbidding as possible. The heat of summer was infernal, water was always short, and food barely adequate. And here's some pictures of the camps. Here's distributing water to the internees. And this is an overview of the winter camp. And here's a poster that Jewish people made. This is Rosh Hashanah on Cyprus. Rosh Hashanah on Cyprus. Even so, the flow of illegals continued to grow, growing momentum. To the British survivors, Cyprus was simply another stepping stone to Palestine. Not infrequently, the DPs resisted British boarding parties, and deaths occurred on both sides. All but five of 63 refugee ships were intercepted between 1945 and 1948, with the internment of 26,000 displaced persons on Cyprus. And this is one of those DP refugee ships that managed to get through, this one landing on the beach at Nahariya in 1948. One of five ships that made it through out of 63. Yeah, this was precisely the message of the refugee tragedy. This was the message the Zionists were determined to convey. Its impact on world opinion and the British taxpayer turned out to be the Jews' most effective weapon. Now we come to 1947 and UN scope. In 1947, the United Nations was chosen as the instrument to cope with the issue of Palestine. Britain turned the fate of Palestine over to the world body on April 2nd, 1947. Subsequently, an 11-nation investigative board was set up on May 13th and entitled the United Nations Special Committee on Palestine, UN scope. So we have another special committee evaluating the Jewish national home, number 5. The committee was a balanced group. However, troubles were brewing from the beginning. Britain insisted it would neither abandon the mandate nor enforce a decision unless the solution were just and acceptable to both Arabs and Jews. Rather improbable expectation. Upon learning that UN scope included the plight of the refugees in their thinking, the Arab states warned that they too would not necessarily be bound by the United Nations recommendation. We may cooperate with the world body we've joined, and we just may not. And hypocrisy like that happened then and today by UN members. This is not unusual for UN members. The UN scope group arrived in the Holy Land in mid-June 1947. The Arab Higher Committee decided to boycott the UN scope hearings. The decision was probably a tactical blunder. Although the United Nations group managed to interview Arabs unofficially during their five-week stay in Palestine, and they sampled their views, but this informal poll hardly compared to the elaborate and documented testimony offered by the Zionists. In addition, the strident, aggressive statements of the Arabs convinced the UN scope members that it would be fatal to leave the Jews as a minority in Arab hands. And has anything changed? This is a report in the Times of Israel about the 31st Congress on the Union of Islamic Organizations, UOIF, in Paris, France, April 23, 2014. And it focuses on Hani Ramadan, a prominent Muslim leader from Geneva. According to the news site www.europe-israel.org, Ramadan said this during his address: "All the evil in the world originates from the Jews and Zionist barbarism. Against these international schemes of Zionist power, there's only one rampart, Islam. I would suggest that the strident aggressive statements are still being made. And now we come to the Exodus 19:47, the story of a ship that launched a nation. While the UN scope group was in Israel, in mid-July, a battered little American Chesapeake Bay ferry, packed with 4,500 DPs, set out from the French port of Sète. Six British destroyers and one cruiser were waiting offshore to meet this dangerous battleship. They immediately escorted the refugee ship, appropriately named Exodus 19:47, across the Mediterranean. Here's that little Chesapeake Bay ferry, packed with all those DPs, ready to destroy the world, in the need of six destroyers and a cruiser to keep it from getting out of hand. Pretty pitiful. 12 miles outside the Palestine territorial waters, the British Armada closed in on the Exodus for boarding. And a furious hand-to-hand struggle ensued. The DPs fought off the boarding party for several hours. Eventually, the British put machine guns and gas bombs into action, killing 3 and wounding 100. All the while, a detailed account of the battle was radioed to Haganah headquarters in Tel Aviv and later rebroadcast around the world. The crew of the Exodus surrendered only when the British began ramming the vessel, threatening to sink it. Sink it, huh? With 4,500 men, women, and children on board? Pretty stupid idea. And British chivalry at its height, I gather. Pretty crazy. Listing badly, the ferry was then towed into Haifa Harbor. And here's the Exodus 19:47 in Haifa. Now, notice that dangling lifeboat there. We'll see that boat later on. So remember it. Here are some of the displaced persons, the refugees being removed from the Exodus 19:47. And then taking care of the wounded and the injured. Here's a young boy being helped to medical care. And here's somebody on a stretcher being moved to medical care. Under ordinary circumstances, the British would have transshipped the boat's passengers to Cyprus. But in the previous 12 months, some 26,000 Jews had been packed into that island, hopelessly overcrowding its two internment camps. In this case, Bevin personally decided to make an example of the refugees by sending them back to their port of origin. Shortly afterward, on British transports, they were essentially prison ships, the DPs were carried off to Marseille, France. There, they refused to disembark. The French government offered the refugees hospitality and medical care, but the offer was rejected. The passengers insisted that their destination was the land of Israel. After 3 weeks, the French government, concerned about the possibility of epidemic sickness, ordered the vessels to depart. At this point, the British cabinet held an emergency meeting and decided its only alternative was to ship the Jews back to Germany. Most of the refugees were thereupon returned to Hamburg. Some 1,500 refused to disembark, and they were carried off by British troops wielding clubs and hoses. Eventually, they were transported by rail to German internment camps. For a month, the British attempted to register them, but the only response they got to all their questions was, Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael. What's your name? Eretz Yisrael. What's your age? Eretz Yisrael. I can just imagine that. The Exodus tragedy was prolonged over 3 months and was extensively reported in newspapers around the world. Now, the UN scope members were not unaffected by the episode. And here's a picture of the UN scope members in Haifa. And they are inspecting the Exodus 19:47. How do I know? Look at that background. Look at the background in the square there. There's that lifeboat dangling. That is the Exodus 19:47 in the background. So they're on site. They were personal witnesses to all that was going on. The representative from Yugoslavia stated of the Exodus episode, it is the best possible evidence we can have. So the Exodus 1947 affair dramatized the fact that the Jews not only needed but desired a national home. Now, this affair became the basis for the movie called Exodus, a 1960 movie, a historical fiction around this incident, starring Paul Newman. Here's another placard of the Exodus movie, the historical fiction movie. This is the book by Leon Uris. He wrote it in 1958. Again, remember, it is historical fiction based on this true event. It's available at Amazon.com. The movie and the book are available at Amazon.com. And this would be a good time to view program number 5 from Against All Odds, Israel Survives. Program number 5 is called A Boy Named Ezra. Good time to view that video, that DVD. All right, the UN General Assembly decides on the partition of Israel. The UN scope report was finished on August 31st, 1947. In it, UN scope laid out 11 guiding principles. The most important stated that the mandate should be ended, and independence granted at the earliest practical date. UN scope divided on a vote of 7-3 into a majority recommending partition into two states and a minority proposing federation, keeping one state. In favoring partition, the majority scheme envisioned an Arab area, comprising Western Galilee, the hill country of Central Palestine, except for the Jerusalem enclave, and the coastal plain from a line south of Ashdod to the Egyptian border. The Jewish territory would include the rest, except for the Jerusalem-Bethlehem area, which would be internationalized. So here is the UN Partition Plan, Resolution 181, November 29, 1947. The Jewish state is the blue area, eastern Galilee, the coastal plain, and then the interior from the south, from about Ashdod, south of the Negev. The Arab state would be the Western Galilee, the Judean hills, and then the coastal plain south of Ashdod down to Egypt. The international zone would surround Jerusalem. Jewish immigration would be allowed to continue at the rate of 6,250 people monthly. In the first 2 years, that would be allowed for a total of 150,000 immigrants, therefore at a rate of 5,000 monthly or 60,000 per year. Now, there was little in the majority report to set the Zionists dancing in the streets. Territorially, it envisioned for both peoples asymmetrical segments that were, quote, entwined in an antagonistic embrace like two fighting serpents, as Herbert Samuel once described the Peel Plan, and he's totally right. However, it offered two indispensable prerequisites. Number one, a nation, sovereignty, and two, uninterrupted flow of immigration for the reasonable future. The Jewish agency therefore expressed cautious satisfaction with the majority report. The Arabs, conversely, rejected it with a passion, as usual. The Arab League formally threatened war if the United Nations approved the UN scope report. On November 25, 1947, the Palestine Committee approved an amended partition plan 25-13. The Arab state would embrace 4,500 square miles, 804,000 Arabs, that's 98.5% of the population, and 10,000 Jewish people, 1.5% of the population. The Jewish state would encompass 5,500 miles, a little bit larger, but it would only comprise 538,000 Jewish people, or 59% of the population, and 397,000 Arab people, or 41% of the population. On November 29th, the partition resolution was submitted to the full session of the General Assembly for a desired vote. The General Assembly resolution was approved by a vote of 33-13, giving it the necessary two-thirds majority. The British mandate was then scheduled to end on May 14, 1948. The Jewish reaction, of course, was jubilation. We would have a state. We would have a state of our own. The Arab reaction understandably, the beginning of the Arab attacks. The initial Arab response to the Palestinian resolution was to carry out its often repeated threat of violence. It set a pattern for the months and the years ahead. The Arab Higher Committee proclaimed a three-day general strike from December 2nd to December 4th, 1947. Violence began immediately with attacks on Jewish quarters in Jerusalem, Haifa, and Jaffa. And so the Jewish community had to begin defending themselves very, very seriously. Here's an example of Jewish defense. Soon after, the Higher Committee began recruiting volunteers throughout Palestine Arab towns and villages, and the result was Arab militias. Their opening tactics were essentially hit-and-run assaults on isolated Jewish settlements and transportation, the pillage and destruction of Jewish property. Now, left to their own devices, Arabs and Jews, for the most part, continued to live together peacefully, if not fearfully, but at least peacefully. And the Higher Committee's violence alone would not have precipitated a full-scale war between the two peoples. But the Palestine Arabs and Jews were not left alone. They were the targets of extremists. And during the September 16, 1947 meeting in Sofar, Lebanon, the Arab League Political Committee appealed for economic reprisals against Britain and the United States and for money and weapons for the Palestine Arabs. Soon, an Arab Liberation Army was organized. General Sir Ismail Safwat Pasha, an Iraqi staff officer, was appointed its commander. Field command was invested in Fazi al-Kuqji, the guerrilla leader of the Palestine Civil War of 1936. Here he is on his horse. Late January of 1948, elements of the Liberation Army began infiltrating over the Palestine border. By the end of March, the number had grown to 7,000 soldiers. Assaults were launched against Jewish quarters in the cities, particularly in Jerusalem. There were concentrated attacks against outlying kibbutzim in the Hebron Hills. The Arabs succeeded during this period in cutting off the roads between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, between Haifa and Western Galilee, between Tiberias and Eastern Galilee, and between Afula and the Beisan Valley. So the Galilee was being isolated. The Jewish farm colonies in the Negev soon were isolated from the rest of Palestine as well. In Jerusalem, the situation of the Jews was particularly grave. By the end of March 1948, as the gauntlet of Arab attacks from the hill areas became increasingly lethal, the entire Haganah convoy system was in danger of collapse. By then, too, the three roads leading to Jerusalem were in the hands of Arab irregulars, and the Jewish population of the city faced the imminent likelihood of being starved or overrun. In late 1947, once the United Nations decision for partition was assured, the Haganah leadership concentrated on two major objectives. The first was the security of the Yishuv against local Arab forces during the six-month period of British withdrawal, so they were dealing with internal forces. And the second was defense of the country against possible full-scale Arab invasion after May 15th, dealing with external forces. That was their two main security objectives. Then we come to the Arab refugees. There were other changes in the configuration of Israel at this time. These were democratic rather than political or geographic. The first of the two phases took place in the months immediately following the partition resolution. Approximately 30,000 Arabs decided to leave Palestine. Most of these immigrants were businessmen and their families from larger cities. Now, the second phase took place in April and May of 1948, as the Jews began to secure the upper hand in Palestine. Arab public services collapsed in the pandemonium of British evacuation. The exodus of Arab families resumed, and at this time it included large numbers of communal officials, village mayors, qadis, those are Muslim priests, and judges, thousands of fellaheen, thousands of peasant farmers and town dwellers began to accompany them. Now, the most dramatic episode of flight in this second phase of Arab departure occurred in Haifa. Approximately 70,000 Arabs lived in this harbor city. On the afternoon of the 22nd, the Jewish mayor of Haifa and his colleagues met with the Arab leaders and pleaded with them to remain in the city with their fellow townsmen. The same afternoon, the reply was conveyed to the mayor and his associates that Arabs would not live for a single day under Jewish rule. Within 36 hours, the remaining Arab population that had not already left, 30,000 souls, left the city and departed for Lebanon, either overland or by sea. Elsewhere, the Arab exodus gained momentum, reaching nearly 175,000 during the last weeks of the mandate. There were various reasons for the flight, but none of those can be traced to an alleged appeal for evacuation by the Arab governments themselves, ostensibly to make way for the impending invasion of the Arab armies. This was a frequently repeated Israeli claim after the war. For example, we read in Israel My Glory, the magazine Israel My Glory, April-May 1991, in page 8, Arab heads of state were warned repeatedly that if the Jewish agency exercised their right to proclaim a new nation, then the Jews would be pushed into the sea by the Arab juggernaut poised at the borders. These Arab leaders had repeatedly told civilian Arabs living near Jewish areas to abandon their homes, assuring them that they could return to them after a sure Jewish bloodbath. Well, that's in Israel My Glory. The voluntary Arab exodus had begun, and hundreds of thousands had already left their homes in Jaffa, Haifa, Lydda, Ramla, and parts of Jerusalem. Well, that's in Israel My Glory. You also read in the Atlas of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, on page 47, the United Nations estimated that over 725 Arabs fled from Palestine between April and December of 1948. The Israelis estimated that between 550 and 600,000 Arabs fled. Many Arabs were encouraged to leave by their own political leaders, who promised them that they would soon be able to return to their homes once Israel had been destroyed. And then in A Complete Idiot's Guide to the Arab-Israeli Conflict, the same claim is made. In his memoirs, Khaled al-Azam, the Syrian prime minister of 1948 to 1949, also admitted the Arab role in persuading the refugees to leave. Since 1948, we have been demanding the return of the refugees to their homes, but we ourselves are the ones who encourage them to leave. And then there's this poster, this Nakba poster, and I'll bring this quote up on the slide. Quote, we brought destruction on half a million Arab refugees by calling on them and pleading with them to leave their land. Again, by Khaled al-Azam, the Syrian prime minister, remarks it made in 1973. And on this poster, there's another quote at the bottom I'll put up on the slide. This is by current Palestinian president Mahmoud Abbas. And he said, the five Arab armies entered Palestine to protect the Palestinians. Yeah, right. Instead, they abandoned them, forced them to immigrate and to leave their homeland, and threw them into prisons. So he blames the Arab armies very, very distinctly. So, but on the other side of the coin, according to Howard Sakhar, no such order for evacuation was ever found in any release of the Arab League or in any military communique of the period. Rather, the evidence of the Arab press and the radio at that time was to the contrary. By and large, the Arab League ordered the Palestinians to stay where they were, and stringent punitive measures were reported against Arab youths of military age who fled the country. Even Jewish broadcasts in Hebrew mentioned these Arab orders to remain. Assam Pasha, Abdullah, and various Arab committees appealed repeatedly to the Arabs not to leave their homes. The Ramallah commander of the Arab Legion threatened to confiscate the property and blow up the houses of those Arabs who left without permission. At one point, the Lebanese government decided to close its frontiers to all Palestinians except women, children, and the aged. So, this issue of the Arab refugees is very controversial. There are strong comments on both sides, so I can't offer a clear-cut opinion regarding one side or the other. However, that the Exodus was voluntary is clear. That is clear. The most obvious reason for the mass exodus was the collapse of Palestine Arab political institutions that ensued after the flight of the Arab leadership at the very moment when leadership was most needed. That was the genuine reason for the refugee exodus. The departure of the Mukhtars, the judges and the like from Haifa, the new city of Jerusalem, from Jaffa, Safed, and elsewhere dealt a grave blow to the Arab population. The semi-feudal character of Arab society rendered the illiterate fella, the illiterate peasant farmer, almost entirely dependent on the landlord, and once this was gone, the Arab peasant was terrified by the likelihood of remaining in an institutional and cultural void. So this was the major cause of the voluntary refugee exodus. I think that's the best explanation. Jewish victories obviously intensified the fear and accelerated departure. In many cases, Jews captured Arab villages, expelled the inhabitants, and blew up houses to prevent them from being used as strongholds against them. In other instances, Kawukji's men used Arab villages as their bases, provoking immediate Jewish retaliation. In addition, Arab leaders gave wide publicity to authentic or rumored acts of atrocity committed by the Zionist enemy. The propaganda worked in the Zionists' favor, however. In April and May, entire Arab communities fled in terror even before Jewish forces overran their homes. By June 11th, when the UN truce came into effect, some 250,000 Arabs had fled the Jewish-occupied areas of the country. Once on the offensive, however, Israel changed its policy toward the local Arabs. No effort was made to persuade them to stay and share in the anticipated benefits of the Jewish state. By spreading warnings ahead of them, the Jews ensured that most Arab settlements were evacuated before the Israeli army arrived. In other words, the Zionists took advantage of the Arab propaganda. The number of Arab immigrants reached 300,000 by July 9th. After hostilities ended, the UN placed the number of Arab fugitives from Israeli-controlled territory at approximately 720,000, 70% of the Arab population. Jewish estimates were 538,000. 180,000 refugees fled toward the Gaza area. Now, the fate of these Gaza derelicts is particularly cruel. They were refused employment. They were refused resettlement, either by Israelis and Egyptians alike, for the next generation. They were destined to vegetate in a confinement as tragic as that endured by the Jewish displaced persons in Europe between 1945 and 1948. Now, here is a map of Palestine refugee movement from Haifa and from the Tel Aviv area and from Beersheba. Palestine refugee movement out of Jewish areas. And then the UNWRA, UN Works Relief Agency, I believe that stands for, set up refugee camps. You can see the little red dots are all refugee camps. And here again are UNRWA refugee camps, the larger circles portraying the larger populations in the camps. And a photograph of some of the Arab Palestinian refugees on the road heading for Arab territories and refugee camps. This is the Khan Yunis, a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip, 1948. And the Yaramana refugee camp in Damascus, Syria. 1971, the new Amman refugee camp in eastern Jordan. Notice this is 1971. These refugees have not been resettled. They've not been integrated back into the Arab countries. This is the Palestinian refugee camp Jabal al-Husseini in Jordan. And you notice it has grown up to be a formal little town. This refugee camp has been there a long time. And the Gaza Strip was a destination for the refugees. You can see the refugee areas in red, I believe, there. Now, WorldNet Daily editor Joseph Farah, on his Mideast Truth Tour on October 202nd, summed up the refugee crisis in this manner. This is found in Merit, Sunday, October 27, 2002. WorldNet Daily editor Joseph Farah stated, Farah attacked the idea that Israel was responsible morally, legally, or in any other way for the displacement of the Arab refugees in 1948 or thereafter. He writes, "The revised history has given the guilty a free ride," he said. "The Arab states that initiated the hostilities have never accepted responsibility, despite their enormous wealth and their ability to assimilate tens of millions of refugees in their largely underpopulated nations. And other states have failed to hold them accountable. It's bad enough the Arab states created a small nation of refugees by their actions. It's worse that they have successfully blamed their international crime on the Jews." Today, of course, this cruel charade continues. Of course, this was written in 2002. "The suffering of millions of Arabs is perpetuated, only for political purposes by the Arab states. They are merely pawns. The refugees are merely pawns in the war to destroy Israel." Farah said that the world has dealt with far more serious refugee crises in the past in much less than 50 years. "There were some 100 million refugees around the world following World War II, he said. "The Palestine Arab group is the only one in the world not absorbed or integrated into their own people's lands. Since then, millions of Jewish refugees from around the world have been absorbed into the tiny nation of Israel. It makes no sense to expect that the same tiny Jewish state, representing just 0.1% of the Mideast landmass, to solve a refugee crisis it did not create." All right, well, let's get on to a new section here. At this point, we finished up section 3, The Rise of Zionism, and I'd like to do a little bit of a theological review for you, just to remember the material we covered in details way back in the beginning in session number 1. Let's begin with the question, what is Zionism? Way back in the beginning of our class, we asked the question, what is Zion? And the answer is the southeastern hill. Zion is the southeastern hill of Jerusalem, where David's fortress was constructed. It lays in between the Kidron Valley on the east and the Tyropian Valley on the west. Here's another view of Jerusalem. Here is the Tyropian Valley on the east and the Kidron Valley on the west. And between the two lies Zion, or the lower city. And this is the view today. This is the Kidron Valley running on the east side of Mount Zion, and there is Mount Zion. That's the way it looks today. You cannot see the Tyropian Valley today. It is all filled in except for one little tiny area near the Western Wall. So what is Zion? Zion is the southeastern hill of Jerusalem. The name eventually came to include the Temple Mount. Later, the name Zion referred to all of Jerusalem, and then to all of Judah, and finally the name became attached to all the Jewish people in some instances. So that is Zion. Now, let's distinguish between modern Mount Zion and biblical Mount Zion. Modern Mount Zion lies to the west of the Tyropian Valley. There's the Tyropian Valley, and this is modern Mount Zion. Now, on our same map, here is the Tyropian Valley, and to the west of the Tyropian Valley, the upper city is modern Mount Zion. Not biblical Mount Zion, this is modern Mount Zion today. It can easily be spotted by viewing the church with the blue cone as a roof. So that's the answer, what is Zion? Now, what is Zionism? We suggest that the definition for Zionism should be a feeling, an emotion. Zionism is an expression of the longing and yearning that the Jewish people have had in the past and still have for their homeland. As soon as any Jew expressed the desire to go back to his land, he's expressing Zionism. And I agree with Dr. Fruchtenbaum on that. And this definition is supported by Psalm 137, verses 1 through 6, for example. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. See the Jewish grief. Upon the willows in the midst of it, we hung our harps. For there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land if I forget you, O Jerusalem? Now notice how Zion and Jerusalem are parallel thoughts here. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. Zionism is the longing of the Jewish people for their homeland. We also talked about the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant was made with Abraham in Genesis 12, 13, 15, and 17. It was confirmed through Isaac, not Ishmael, in Genesis 26, confirmed through Jacob, not Esau, in Genesis 28, and then confirmed to all 12 tribes, to all descendants, in Genesis 49. And this, by the way, is the biblical definition of who is a Jew. A Jew is a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It is a family relationship. As Amos 3:2 indicates, you only have I chosen. There's the chosen people, the chosen family. I have chosen among all the families of the earth. Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. So being a Jew is being a member of the family that descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Abrahamic covenant is made up of three basic promises, a land promise, a nation promise, and a spiritual blessing promise. The land promise, the land of Israel, is twofold. It's to you. I promise the land to you, Abraham, and to your descendants, as seen in Genesis 13, 14 through 17, for example. The Lord said to Avram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see I will give to you, Avram, and to your descendants, the Jewish people, forever, down to this very day. So that's the land promise. Then the nation promise is twofold. First of all, national election, and this chosen family will experience a unique relationship with the Gentile nations. In Genesis 12:2, I will make you into a great nation. There's a promise of numerous people to live in that land. And then the unique relationship, I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse. That's not said of any other nation in the world, not America, not Britain, not Russia, not India, not China, not Iran, not Iraq, only of the Jewish people. So we have the land promise and the national promise, and finally the spiritual blessing promise, again twofold, I will bless you, and you will bless others. Genesis 12. 2 and 3, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. There's the promise to Abraham, and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and curse those who curse you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So there's the two aspects of the blessing promise, personal and corporate or external. Now, the Abrahamic covenant is also eternal. We learn in a number of verses there on the slide, and it is unconditional or unilateral, meaning basically unconditional or unilateral basically means that only one party is responsible for the fulfillment of this covenant, and that one party is God alone. Fulfillment of the covenant is not a responsibility that rests on the Jewish people. It rests on God alone. He has taken that responsibility on himself. Now, the eternal, unconditional, and unilateral Abrahamic covenant and its three promises is expanded and developed by three additional eternal and unconditional covenants God made with the Jewish people. The spiritual blessing promise expanded and developed by the new covenant of Jeremiah 31, Ezekiel 36. The national promise expanded and developed by the Davidic covenant, 2 Samuel, 1 Chronicles, Psalms 89. And the land promise expanded and developed by the land covenant of Deuteronomy 29 and 30. So let's take a look at the land covenant, since that would be the focus of our class. In Deuteronomy chapter 29, verse 1, we learn that it is a distinct covenant. These are the words of the covenant, which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he made with them at Horeb. So it is a distinct covenant. It's a covenant in the land of Moab, besides, another key word, the covenant which he made with them at Horeb. Those are the key words. Now here's a map of the area. This is the plains of Moab. This is where the land covenant was instituted. And this is the Horeb mountain range, where the Mosaic covenant was instituted. So we have two distinct covenants in two distinct locations. So that is verse 1. Then in verses 2 through 27, Israel's past, present, and future history, unfortunately, of disobedience is reviewed. And an example of this is verses 26 and 27. They went and served other gods and worshipped them, gods whom they had not known and whom he had not allotted to them. Therefore the anger of the Lord burned against that land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. And the Lord uprooted them from the land, and this is part of the land covenant, in anger and in fury and in great wrath, and cast them into another land as it is this day. Then in verses 28 through chapter 30, verses 1 and 2, dispersion is promised for discipline. The discipline of dispersion is promised. It will be worldwide in nature, but in that worldwide dispersion, repentance will be experienced. And so it shall be, when all these things have come upon you, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before you, and you call them to mind in all the nations, there's the dispersion, where the Lord your God has banished you, and you return to the Lord your God, there's repentance, and obey him with all your heart, that repentance is sincere, and you obey him with all your heart and your soul, according to all that I command you today, you and your sons. So that's the third aspect of the land covenant, dispersion on a worldwide basis and repentance. And then comes the last element in verses 3 through 10, which is restoration. And that's what lies into Israel's future. Then the Lord your God will restore you from captivity and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the peoples where the Lord your God has scattered you. So it's again a worldwide return. If you're outcasts or at the ends of the earth, from there, the Lord your God will gather you, and from there, he will bring you back. So in summary, the land covenant is distinct. It reviews Israel's disobedience and the discipline of dispersion. But in that dispersion, repentance will occur, and there will be restoration in store for Israel's future. That's a summary of the land covenant. And we have experienced the history of dispersion and return, and yet the land has always been our possession. For example, there was our sojourn in Egypt. We went briefly to Egypt and returned around 2000 BC. That was Abraham, and his famine that sent him into Egypt. But this brief sojourn into Egypt was limited to Egypt, and Abraham then returned to the land that God had promised him. Then came the Egyptian slavery around 1800 BC in Genesis 46. We went into Egypt, and then we returned in around 1406 under Joshua. But this exodus and return was limited to Egypt. And the territory of Israel, the land promised to the Jewish people, was still considered ours. Then came the Babylonian exile, 605 BC and 2 Kings 25. We returned in 536 BC under Ezra and Nehemiah to our own land. And this exile was limited to the Middle East. So far, we have no exiles that are worldwide in nature. Then we come to the Roman exile in 70 AD, Matthew 23. We were regathered for judgment in 1948, Ezekiel 20, verses 33 through 38. This is a worldwide regathering, the first worldwide regathering. Then there'll be, we await the tribulation exile, which will occur in the midpoint of the tribulation, Matthew 24. We will be regathered for blessing to our land at the second coming, Isaiah 11, Matthew 24, again from a worldwide dispersion. Now, if you'd like more information on this, I would suggest the Messianic Bible Study Collection, Manuscript 132, The Blessings and Cursings, The Outworking of the Mosaic Covenant in Leviticus 26. And we'll briefly overview the blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant. The blessings, in Leviticus 26, verses 1 and 2, we see that obedience is required, and the conditional nature of blessing is spoken. If you obey, then you will be blessed with these blessings: prosperity, power, security, peace, and in verses 11 through 13, my presence. But then we come to the cursing aspect. If you do not obey me, disobey me, you will be disciplined with sickness, harassment, and insecurity. If you continue to disobey me, I will ramp up the discipline and you will suffer drought and famine. If you continue to disobey me, wild animals will harass you. And all these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasion. And I drew us a timeline. And so from the book of Judges in 1406 B.C. through the Assyrian invasions, we experienced sickness, harassment, insecurity, drought, famine, and wild animals. This was discipline of a mild intensity. If you continue to disobey me in verses 23 through 26, you'll experience the horrors of siege. This was experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. Back to our timeline, we go down our timeline, and during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions, we experienced the horrors of siege, which is discipline of an increasing intensity. Then in verses 27 through 33, if you continue to disobey me, you'll experience devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. And this was experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. So back to our timeline, we go down the timeline. So during the Babylonian and destructions and Roman destructions, we experienced devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. The fullness of judgment was dispersion out of the land. While we're dispersed out of the land will be resting and desolate. This was experienced after the Babylonian and Roman destructions. So we move down our timeline. After the Babylonian destruction for 70 years and after the Roman destruction for 2,000 years, the land was resting and desolate. Then in verses 36 and through 39, the state of the people during the dispersion is described as fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. This was experienced after the Roman destruction. So let's go down our timeline. So after the Roman destruction, AD 70 to 1948, the state of the people was fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. But then in verses 40 through 46, restoration is promised. Restoration from a worldwide dispersion for kingdom blessings. So let's move down our timeline. And at the end, restoration, we experienced peace and an end to suffering in the Messianic kingdom. And you notice I've left a gap there. What falls into that gap? What falls there is the Antichrist destruction, the tribulation, this diaspora that is to come. It is the most severe discipline we will ever experience. So that awaits the Jewish community. So where are we today? Well, we are living after the Roman destruction and before the Antichrist destruction. So our class and our personal experience exists right here during the first regathering, modern Israel. We're experiencing the first regathering. Then I define the times of the Gentiles using Luke 21:24, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So the times of the Gentiles lasts from the Babylonian destruction in 586 BC until the second coming and the Messianic kingdom. Now we ask the question, have the Jewish people ever possessed all of the promised land? And the answer is no. The largest possession of the Promised Land was under Solomon's kingdom. That's the most influence over the land at its greatest extent. The principle here is that Jewish ownership of the land is unconditional, based on the Abrahamic covenant, but enjoyment of the land blessing, enjoyment of the land promise, is contingent upon obedience. So we looked at the principle of expansion for obedience, Deuteronomy 8:19. If the Lord your God enlarges your territory, so the territory needs to be enlarged, just as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land which he promised to give to your fathers, if you carefully observe all the commandments, see, it's obedience, which I command you today, to love the Lord your God and walk in his ways, then, you know, I'll expand your land, and you'll have to add three more cities for yourself besides these three. So there's expansion promised for obedience, but there's contraction promised for disobedience. 2 Kings 10:31 and 32 is an example of this. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sons of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin. In those days, what happens? The Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. So I've graphed this out for you. I've charted this out for you, so perhaps it'll be easier to see. This is our ancient possession of the land. Under Abraham, we really didn't possess much. Under Judges, we possessed maybe 20% of the land. Under the United Kingdom, up to 70% of the land. Here is Saul's kingdom. Under obedient David, it was expanded to David's kingdom. And in the beginning, under Solomon, obedient Solomon, it was expanded up to the Euphrates River. But then the kingdom was divided and we began to lose land when we lost the northern kingdom under the Assyrian conquest, and then we lost the southern kingdom to the Babylonians. We returned after 70 years and began to regain our land under the Hellenistic period. But then when the Romans took over in the first century, we lost some of our territory. And then came the worldwide dispersion under the Romans, and we were out of the land altogether. But now modern possession of the land. We start with the first worldwide dispersion, where very little of the land is possessed by Jewish people. And the first worldwide regathering, 1839 to 1948, we begin to buy back our land and possess it. In the War of Independence, you'll see that we will gain more of our land, up to 30%. During the Six-Day War, that percentage will rise to about 40%, and that'll stay consistent throughout the Yom Kippur War, the Lebanon War, the Gulf War. And then when the peace process begins in 1991, we'll begin to lose land again. Where will it go in the near future? I have no idea. We'll have to see what God has in mind. But we do know that the second worldwide dispersion, the tribulation, will occur. We'll be kicked out of the land again, only to have Jesus return. And then in the kingdom, we will possess 100% of the land. So there are two worldwide regatherings predicted for the Jewish people. The first one is in unbelief, in judgment. That judgment will be experienced during the tribulation, Ezekiel 20, 33 through 38. And the second worldwide regathering in faith for blessing, the blessing of the kingdom, Isaiah 11, verses 11 and 12. Two worldwide regatherings of the Jewish people. Then we reviewed the prophetic events that have taken place, World War I and II. Have taken place, the reestablishment of the State of Israel has occurred, and Jerusalem under Jewish control. Now, certain prophetic events have not taken place. The Russian invasion of Israel has not occurred. The one world government has not come into being. From that, the ten kingdoms, it'll split into ten kingdoms, and from the ten kingdoms, the Antichrist will rise, and there'll be a period of peace and false security before Israel signs a seven-year covenant with the Antichrist that begins the tribulation period. And the Russian invasion of Israel is the next prophetic event we should anticipate. Now, prophetic events that cannot be chronologically arranged. We don't know when the rapture of the church will occur. We don't know when the first worldwide blackout will occur, or the return of Elijah, or the building of the third temple. It can go up tomorrow. It could go up during the tribulation. We just don't know. Okay, well, that brings us to an end. I'm sorry, I'm a little over time. I'm a minute or two over time. But that brings us to the end of our third section in this class, the first regathering, Zionism and the Modern State of Israel. We have dealt with the rise of Zionism in section 3. Now we will move our next session into section 4, and we'll begin to look at Israel present. So thank you so much for being our students. This is a good time to view the DVD, Israel, a Nation is Born, put together by or hosted by Foreign Minister Abba Eban. Look at the program on disc 1. It's a 60-minute program dealing with Zionism from Zionism till 1948. So this is a good time to view that section of A Nation is Born. All right. Thank you so much for being our students. We'll catch you next session. Lahithraot.